Lloyd Pye graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology. He then joined the U.S. Army and became an agent for military intelligence. Now, during this time, Mr. Pye began an independent study of human evolution. At age 30, his studies led him to conclude that humans could not possibly have evolved on Earth according to the Darwinian paradigm. By age 40, he could illustrate his belief by comparing skeletons in the so-called pre-human fossil record and those reported to belong to the world's four basic types of hominoids. Lloyd is probably best known in alternative circles as the caretaker of the famous Starchild skull, the complete bone cranium that looks like a hybrid between a human and some other kind of alien being. Our guest tonight, Lloyd Pye. Always a pleasure, Lloyd. How are you?
I'm fine, George. Good to be with you again.
You too. Now, you've been quite busy these days, haven't you?
Well, yeah, lately I've been pretty busy. I just finished an 8,000-mile car trip to Seattle from Florida to do a Bigfoot conference up there, one of the few that I've done in that field, although it's one of my personal interests and one of the major areas of my research.
Lloyd, for some new listeners, and I hate to rehash all the time, but it's important that we do that. Tell us a little bit about the Star Child, when it was found, how it was found.
Well, it was found in the northwestern part of, the northeastern part of Mexico in about 1930 near the Copper Canyon area, if people know where that is. And it was found, there were two skulls found, a human skull and the Star Child. They were found in a mine tunnel by a young girl who was out exploring an area that she shouldn't have been, and she had been told not to go in the caves and mine tunnels in the area, and she did, and she found a human skeleton lying on its back in the mine tunnel, and beside it she noticed what she called a misshapen hand coming up out of the dirt in the mine tunnel, and it was a loose grave, because being in a mine tunnel it had not been rained on and had not been impacted, so she was able to dig with her hands to see where that hand was coming from, and she uncovered a complete skeleton, which she called misshapen as well, and it was smaller than the human skeleton, which later we measured it out to be approximately 5 feet tall, so we're talking something in the range of 4 feet for the Star Child skeleton or the skeleton in the hole. She was able to recover the two skulls, didn't tell anybody, brought them home, and just kept them for the rest of her life, basically in a cardboard box. And later they passed down to another couple, then passed to another couple, and that couple is the couple that contacted me about it in 1998. And I began the process of trying to bring it to the attention of scientific people so that we could, you know, get the testing done on it that needed to be done, and met the usual resistance one might assume would be something like this would generate. So it's been a 6-year project to get it to the point that we are now, but now we have had a number of very technical scientific tests done on it, and the results have all been, in every case, moving us forward, revealing interesting things about it, but also very unusual things that don't match up with human physiology. So we feel like we're on the right track with an absolutely genuine relic that can be determined eventually to be not entirely human, but we're still doing things that have to be done in order to nail that down, because it's such an important case and it has to be done in such a comprehensive way that it's just not an easy nor a quick solution to it. And that's been one of the real difficulties of it, is that it's just so hard to get proper attention paid to it, and also to, of course, get the money to pay for the things that have to be done.
Well, I know you've been working at this, Lloyd, for a very, very long time in the years that I've known you, and it's good to know that it's slowly getting to a point where you're happy with. Now, have they ruled out any kind of syndromes? I mean, there's a syndrome called Treacher-Collins.
Right. There's Treacher-Collins, there are a number of others, and yeah, all of those are ruled out, because when you look at any kind of physical deformity, George, there's a hallmark to it, which is it looks, in terms of the skeleton, it looks ugly. It looks asymmetrical. It looks lopsided. Now, Treacher Collins is one of the few that has some symmetry about it, because the lower part of the face tends to be deformed on both sides roughly approximately equally. So that, you know, it's not a firm and hard rule that asymmetry, but in almost all cases, that's a hallmark. It just simply doesn't come out looking good. The Star Child is very highly symmetrical, but the other thing about Treacher Collins or any of the Crouzons or any of the others that might be considered is this: whatever the affected area of the head by the syndrome, as in Treacher Collins, the lower part of the face, and Crouzon, the rear part of the head.
And it's a horrible syndrome.
But in every case, whatever isn't affected is still normal. It's still human. It still has the proper density, the proper shape, and all of that. The Star Child, on the other hand, is uniformly, top to bottom, side to side, in every dimension, it is different. And so what you're looking at is something that was transformed, you know, not deformed, but transformed into something else. The bone is uniformly lighter, it's uniformly thinner, and it's two or three times as strong as normal human bone. So it, in every way, it's got the right parts, and the parts are put together in the correct positions, but the parts themselves are all reshaped into something else, and the bone itself has been reconstituted into something else.
Now, the human skull that was found next to it of the adult, that was normal, right?
Normal. The only thing different about it, George, is that it was cradleboarded in youth. And when you say normal for us, that's not normal. But for 900 years ago, that was normal. Cradleboarding is when a woman in a primitive society is not allowed to you know, rest very long after childbirth. They're up in a day or two or three at the most, back to work. And so when they take their babies out into the fields to do the work that they have to do, particularly stooping over, if they carry the baby on their back, it's going to snap its head around and it can break its neck. So they tie the heads down to a board and put the board on their back like a backpack.
Right.
And so that protects the baby, but it also flattens the rear of the head in a very particular way that always looks relatively the same. Doesn't hurt you, doesn't hurt the baby or anything.
Does your head
with a very flat rear of the head. And if you look at the pictures on the website of the comparison shots with the human skull and the Star Child, you'll see that the rear of her head is extraordinarily flat for the area going down to the knot at the back of her head, which we all have that knot at the rear of our head called the inion, and the flattening goes down to that, and that's where your neck attaches, and it stops there, and that's the case with every cradle-boarded head.
Yeah, because you supplied us with several photographs to look at. And,
right.
They are pretty remarkable. Now, when we last talked about a year or so ago, you were planning to try to get some kind of scientific testing, as you've talked about.
Right.
Did you go somewhere? What I've heard that you've been all over the world.
Well, not all over the world, but I did go to England, and I spent a year in England because we got a funding source there who was willing to have me over, allow me to live in her house, and put up the money to do the testing that we needed done. So we've had some remarkable successes. Now, what led to that was the DNA research, and this same lady put up the money for that as well. So we were really, really gifted in the fact that we finally found somebody who was willing to put down serious money to get done the serious work that we needed done.
How did you find her? What was her interest in the Star Child?
Well, she just had followed the case for some time through the periodic updates that I would put out on the website, through the website, and she couldn't understand why nobody would come through with the money that we needed to get it done. And so she asked me a lot of questions, and we went back and forth and back and forth, and I just kept explaining to her, mm-hmm. you know, what the situation was, till eventually she said, well, I want to know. I want to know, and I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, basically, and let's get to work and get it done. So That was in 2003, and so we were able to get the DNA testing done. Now, that was extremely interesting, the results of that, because what we expected at 900 years ago in a mine tunnel, we figured that if the you know, skeletons had not been rained on and not been exposed to the sun, had not been degraded in any way, probably the DNA would still be there and still be, even at 900 years, fresh enough at least to get the mitochondrial DNA and perhaps able to get the nuclear DNA. And if it was done by a lab that specializes in recovering ancient DNA, so we finally found one that could do this very highly specialized work. These are the guys that had worked on the Kennewick Man, for example, which I know everybody knows about. And so we took it to them, and they ran tests on both skulls. The human skull, its mitochondrial DNA and its nuclear DNA pulled up beautifully and easily the first time. The Star Child's mitochondrial DNA, which comes from its mother, pulled up beautifully too, four times. But in those same four tests, the nuclear DNA never did come up. Now, what that tells you is one of two things, that somehow, some way, the nuclear DNA was degraded in some unusual way that allowed the mitochondrial DNA to come up, but not the nuclear DNA, or the primers that were sent in to search for the nuclear DNA, which are designed to search for human DNA, couldn't find what they were looking for, which would mean that the nuclear DNA is not human.
Oh, that's dramatic if they can really prove that.
Well, the thing to say it is one thing, but to prove it is another. In other words, what the geneticists have to say is that it has to be degradation, because they're not going to say, well, because we're not recovering nuclear DNA here, that means ipso facto that it's alien DNA. They can't do that. You know, they'd be laughingstocks, because there is that other alternative, which is degradation, although there's no sign of it in the human one, and there's no sign of it in the recovery of the mitochondrial DNA. So you and I can sit here, and everyone listening here can sit here and say, well, we're pretty sure it means that the primers couldn't recover human DNA because it's not in there. But scientifically, from a scientific standpoint, we have to do more to prove the case than that. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and we're caught in that crossfire of having to supply extraordinary proof, even though we have a very strong indication from that that that's not human nuclear DNA in the Star Child skull.
Well, this fiber that was found in bone,
right?
Unlike anything that you would find in a human,
right? Exactly. What happened was after we did the DNA testing, what we were left with was only the possibility of doing intense biochemical testing on the bone to see if we could find, you know, break it down to the atom level and see what we could find out from that standpoint. So we started the process by looking with a scanning electron microscope to see just what you could see on the surface of the bone at high magnification. And what we found, and what people can see, by the way, on the website, www.starchild-uk, RC, I think, on your website, what you'll see is that inside the cancellous holes of the Star Child, and the cancellous holes, to understand how it works, in the bone of your skull, it's like kind of like a sandwich. You have a piece on the top that's solid, you have a piece on the bottom that's solid, but inside between there, sandwiched in between, are what's called cancellous holes, and that is where the marrow moves through that bone. And coming out of those cancellous holes, as you can see on the photos, are thread-like things or fiber-like things. And we don't know what they are. No one's ever seen them. Nobody yet who's looked at them has an idea of what they are. They're certainly not found in normal human bone. But more importantly, George, when the bone was cut, the guys cutting it who have cut an awful lot of bone said,
boy,
this is hard to cut. This is really hard. So we think maybe those fibers might have something to do with the durability of the bone, because you'll notice the bone itself was cut with a Dremel blade, and the bone was cut, and yet those fibers resisted being cut. They laid up against the bone, and there they sit. So they're obviously very durable material, whatever they are.
That's interesting. You would think that the blade would have been able to just zap right through it.
If they would have cut through anything, you would think they would cut through little bitty fibers like that. I mean, these things are extremely small, and yet, if you look on the pictures, you see there they are, and there's plenty of them. There's not just one. There's plenty of them.
I mean, at this point, can you say anything definitively yet about the skull?
Well, what we can say is that it's certainly very, very, very unusual and unlike any human skull yet discovered. We can say that without fear of contradiction. Can we yet say that it is definitively and for sure proven to be alien? Not quite yet. We have to continue working on that. And that's part of what I'm doing, is letting people know that we've come, what I consider, way past the halfway point. But we're still not there. We need to do more work. We need to do more testing. And I'm here to let people know. And I'm also here to, I'm starting to write a book about this.
So you're going to publish on this?
Going to publish all this so people can see the pictures particularly, hear the story of what we've been through, see where we are at this point. And we're hoping, frankly, by the end of the year and by the end of the writing of the book, to have another round of major round of testing done. We just completed testing on the inorganic parts of the bone and found that the two skulls did indeed grow up in the same general area, but were raised somewhat separately from each other because there's enough differences in the inorganic materials in their bones to indicate that they lived at least part of their lives apart from each other, which makes sense in the story that we've been told.
Be interesting, Lloyd, if this star child was indeed a hybrid, and next hour we'll talk about hybrids, if for some reason they left it behind, maybe to get nurtured a little bit more by its human mother, and maybe they were going to come back and get it, and then it perished, died. Is that a possibility?
That was the story that we thought for a very long time, George, that we were looking at a mother and child. But one of the things that the DNA testing told us was that these two beings were not genetically related. One is from haplogroup A, one is from haplogroup C, so it's pretty clear that they were not mother and child. However, whatever their relationship was, it was a very close bond because based on the scenario as given, the human skeleton found lying on its back on the dirt, and the hand, the misshapen hand wrapped around the arm, what we're talking about here is a death and a suicide. Now, whether that death was accidental, whether it was a disease, sickness of some kind, whether it was a murder, whatever, the star child died first and was buried by the human, and then she laid down and died with it. So it was a close relationship, whatever it was.
Speculate for us, Lloyd, when we come back around the half here, on if this was some kind of alien intervention, how you think it might have been done, how the procedure was done, and why it was done. Were there any other similar skulls found any place on this planet like that?
There's no other skull like the Star Child skull. It is unique to my knowledge, and people have sent me every kind of weird-looking skull you can imagine. But there is another group of skulls that are every bit as unique and I think interesting and demanding of attention as the Star Child skull, and those are the conehead skulls from Peru. And the coneheads, I think, probably are going to prove to be not entirely human as well.
Very interesting. All right, stay with us. Lloyd Pye, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Look at the slides that Lloyd has provided to us of the Star Child. His website, lloydpye.com, P-Y-E, by the way. And also starchildproject.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment. Well, this is an entire week of strange, mysterious, and paranormal shows for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. But we begin it this week with Lloyd Pye and the Star Child. Next hour, we'll talk with Lloyd about hybrids, get his take on just what might be going on. Then the last hour, your turn, phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, if this is indeed an alien hybrid, why that region? Do we have reports of anything that might have occurred 900 years ago, 1,000 years ago, any kind of unusual activity that may have been written on scriptures, on any kind of templates, anything?
No, they weren't writing apparently in that area at that time, George, so there's nothing like that at 1100 A.D. in that area. However, there are a number of stories that are called collectively star being legends. And those say that, and these can be found in from primitive areas, from tribal areas, going from Tierra del Fuego all the way up to Alaska. And those stories collectively have the same general theme, which is that aliens or beings come from the heavens, come down, make a woman in a village in a primitive area pregnant, and generally it's a woman who has not been pregnant before, who is barren, and they make her pregnant with what they call a star being or a star child, and she is charged with raising it, and the village is charged with raising it and helping her to do that because they say they're going to come back and get it one day when it's 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years old. Now, whether this is germane to the story of the star child or not is obviously speculation, but those stories exist, and here you have a being that could be a child. Now, keep in mind, we don't know to this day for sure whether or not it is a child. It has aspects that would indicate that it might well be a child, but then there are other aspects of it that indicate that it's not, that it could be very much older.
Could be almost like one of those little grays.
It could well be a gray type or have some gray about it. But understand, we are pretty sure, based on the mitochondrial DNA, that it had at least a human mother. Now, when you're talking about hybridization, and this may address some of what we'll talk about in the next hour, but when you're talking about hybridization with a human being, at least, you're going to almost have to use the mother as the human. The human is going to have to be the mother, because if you're going to have to manipulate one of the germ cells, it has to be the egg, because that's big enough to take into a genetics lab and manipulate. A sperm is just too small. So if you're going to hybridize and you don't have an easy link, it's not a natural, quote, natural link, then you're going to have to manipulate something in order to make make it happen. And so the egg is what you have to manipulate. So we always felt that the human end of the equation, if it was a hybrid, would be the mother. And that's what turned out to be the case with the mitochondrial DNA, which is why we could recover that with primers designed to recover human DNA. It has that. But again, the mitochondrial DNA comes only from the mother, so that part of it makes sense.
What are the possibilities that this mother mated with some kind of human creature? I don't know. Maybe it has a head like a little Sasquatch head or something like that. What are the possibilities of that?
I don't think anything. It's nothing like anything in the primate world that we know here on this planet, because a Sasquatch, and I know an awful lot about this as well, is going to be like your standard primates. It's going to be like a chimp or a gorilla or something like that. It's going to have a heavy brow ridge, no forehead. You know, the same, the prognathous face, it's going to have those same characteristics. The star child doesn't have any of those. It stands alone. It's just absolutely unique. As I said before, there's nothing else out there that anybody's ever seen or at least recorded and put into a book of any kind as a deformity that we know of. Now, that is not to say, George, that if we were to prove, I mean, absolutely lock it down tight, that the star child is from something other than a human, a full human, something other than entirely human. Probably within the next few days or weeks or maybe months, skulls are going to start popping out of the back drawers of museums, and somebody's going to remember, say, hey, remember that old skull? We didn't know what to make of it, so we just put it away. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe it's one of them. And they'll, you know, you could very easily come up with more. Because science tends to just ignore what doesn't fit the pattern. We all know that. They just look at it. If it isn't right, they just shrug and say, oh, well, it's just something weird. Just put it over there and don't worry about it. It doesn't fit. Just put it away instead of looking at it. And I get that reaction from some of them when I try to show it to them and try to get them to talk about it. They just say, look, it's some kind of deformity. I don't know what it is, but it's a natural, normal thing. There's no such thing as aliens, and they just go on. They won't take it seriously. So part of the challenge for these whole 6 years has just simply been to get scientists to find those that would take it seriously.
So what do you do next, Lloyd, in terms of the DNA testing? What other kind of testing do you need to do, and what's this procedure? How long will this take?
Well, right now what we've done is we've decided to focus on the biochemistry of the bone itself. So we, as I said, we've just completed a round of testing of the isotopes of the inorganic isotopes of the bones, of the two bones. What we're initiating now is a testing process of the organic compounds in the bone, of the organic materials, to see if those are different. Now, we expect the organics will be considerably different. We would assume they would. We don't know. You never know before you get the results, but that's what we're thinking. Now, the gold standard of this thing has always been the DNA, and it will continue to be the DNA until we can find the nuclear DNA, recover it, and see what it's made of. We can't see dad's DNA. We can't see the father's DNA. Now, if it's there, and I assume that it is, it could be recovered, but we would have to create our own primers. Excuse me, we'd have to construct our own primers step by step, piece by piece, base pair by base pair. This is a really expensive process. I think I was quoted $300,000 at one point. It could be done, but we can't get the money hardly just to do the little, you know, the little things we want to do, much less something like that. So part of what I have to do, part of my job as I see it, is I've got to bring this to the attention of somebody who's either got that kind of money or some institution or group of individuals who will say, look, we're going to throw the kitchen sink at this thing. We're going to do everything conceivably possible to prove exactly what it is, and we're going to let the chips fall where they may. And if it says not entirely human, it's not entirely human. If it says it is human, then it is. But until we can get somebody to make that kind of commitment financially and technically, we're still going to be circling the edges of this thing. But we, again, in my opinion, we've done enough now that we're well past the halfway point of proving our case. Not to the degree that science will accept at this point, but I don't know what more they want. We've got everything right in terms of the DNA, except we can't recover the nuclear DNA because the primers don't seem to pick up. And we've got the fibers that we've found, and we've got the red residue that we haven't talked about yet, but which can also be seen on your website or on the Star Child website. And let me add this real quick. You said that it's www.starchildproject.com. That's the old Star Child site. Still
there's
a lot of reports there.
Okay.
But the new one, where the good stuff is start www.starchild-uk.com or -uk.com.
Okay.
And that's where you can see the slideshows, and particularly the second one with what I'm talking about, the fibers and the red residue. Now, that red residue, which we didn't talk about, was found not with the scanning electron microscope, but with another process entirely that left the cancellous holes. Remember those holes where the bone marrow travels?
Mm-hmm.
Which left those absolutely clean. It's a very remarkable process how they do it. In normal human bone, when you die, you carry all the bacteria that reduces you to nothing. That's how Mother Nature cleans her plate. So there are bacteria that will eat out every last shred of bone marrow from your bone.
Clean as a whistle.
Clean as a whistle. And so if you look at the human bone in those slides, you see that that's exactly the case. It shines. It looks like alabaster. It's so clean. If you look at the Star Child, very different. The Star Child is loaded with extra material in itself that makes it kind of have a milky color, and that's part of the, you know, part of the density issue of it. And it has this reddish residue, little specks of it left in a number of places.
And now, that's obviously not blood, right?
Well, see, that's the thing. We don't know what it is. If it was blood, you'd think it would be black because blood tends to do that.
Sure.
So
especially after 900
years.
We
don't know what it is. But if it's organic, and that's the thing, you almost have to assume that it's organic. If it's organic, the DNA should have pulled up very easily, the nuclear DNA, but it didn't. And we took it to the geneticist first thing when we saw it and said, is there any way you could have missed this? And they said, no, that has to be inorganic, because if it was organic, we couldn't have missed it. And yet, if it is organic, then that is a home run. But the problem with both the fibers and the reddish residue is it's never been seen before. Nobody knows what it is, and there's no protocol in place for either recovering those things or testing them.
Is it some kind of fungus or some kind of virus?
Well, the first thing we did, George, it was the first thing we thought was that it might be some kind of fungus, so or any other kind of thing like that. So we took it to some specialists in that field, some mycologists. In fact, we took it to the very top mycologist in England, and he said, well, you're looking at 30,000 possibilities. But he said, in my opinion, I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think that's what it is. It would have to be tested with something called a MALDI-TOF test, which we have not done yet. Again, this is, you know, all this costs money, and we have to marshal our funds and put them where we think they'll do the most good.
Sure.
There is a test to prove it, but based on his say-so, which was that he didn't think it was, we're going with probably not bacteria or fungi.
You don't think that the skull could have any kind of disease on it, do you?
No, we don't, because, again, it was buried for 900 years. When the woman recovered the skulls, apparently within a couple of years, she put shellac over the tops of them. And if you look at the photographs of the outer surfaces, and we have some comparison photos, and if you just look at the outer surface of the bone, the comparisons, that shine that you see is the shellac that she put on it. That really was a good thing she did, because it protected them and kept them, you know, in very good shape,
mm-hmm.
and kept, you know, human finger oils from soaking into the bone and all that. So they're really fairly pristine because of it. And there does not, and then she put them in a cardboard box and kept them in her garage for the next 60 some odd years. So in that area where she came from, which is the dry desert southwest, the odds on it being any kind of bacteria or fungus really are very, very low.
What do people, researchers, say, Lloyd, when they see this skull, when they touch it, when they work with it?
When they see the skull, mostly, if you're talking about mainstream scientists, they just try to dismiss it very quickly, just say, oh, well, it has to be a cradle-boarded hydrocephalic, or, as you said, Treacher Collins, mm-hmm. or Cruzon, or they just throw things out. And when I begin to explain to them that it can't be whatever they're saying because of these reasons, generally they tend to get mad and show me the door. the classic example, I think, probably was Stephen Jay Gould about a year or so before he died. And when I put it in his hands and showed it to him, he said, look, it's just some kind of deformity. I don't know what it is. And I said, well, let's talk about that for a minute. And I tried to engage him in conversation about it. And after a couple of minutes, he just raised his hand and stopped me. And he says, listen, anything is possible in the world of deformity. And I am going to assume that this is just some kind of weird deformity. And you should, too. And that was the end of it. I mean, you know, he just didn't want to deal with it.
Well,
that's the reaction you get from most of them.
If they don't understand what else could be out there, you know, if they don't talk to the people like Bud Hopkins and you and Stanton Friedman and the late John Mack at the time and David Jacobs and people who have seen another side of the possibilities, I guess I could understand how a mainstream scientist would think a deformity first and foremost. But then when these other scientists who have a familiarity with what I've just mentioned, then I think they'd be more apt to say, this is different, Lloyd, don't you?
Absolutely not, George, because their job is to maintain the status quo. They work their way up through a system that is based on maintaining status quo. And once they achieve any degree of status within the field, they're going to have homes and mortgages and all of those things. So even if they go home at night and say to their partner, you know, honey, you won't believe what I saw today.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. An alien. I had an alien
in the world.
In my head.
No, this is normal. Don't worry about it. Everything remains the same. Go to sleep tonight. Sleep tight. The world is under control. We're in charge. Don't worry. You know, that kind of attitude. That's their job.
Where's the skull now?
Well, the skull now is with the owners, and they keep it under lock, obviously under lock and key. I get pieces of it carved off when I need them for testing, but I had the two skulls for the first about 3 years of this project. But as soon as we started cutting on it, well, actually 2 years, and as soon as we started cutting on it, I started taking a stereolithographic copy around because, you know, it just didn't look good anymore. And I've been taking, I show people that stereolithographic copy, which looks exactly like the original did in the beginning. But now we've cut several chunks off of it. I mean, still, there's still plenty left. Don't get me wrong.
I mean, does it still look like a skull?
Excuse me?
Does it still look like a skull?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's had maybe six major, you know, pieces cut off, but those pieces are maybe the size of a square inch or something.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't bad. There's still plenty of it, and it's repairable. When all the cutting is done, as the Jim Croce song says, when all the cutting is done,
yeah.
We'll be able to repair it at a place called Bone Clones. They'll be able to make it look very close to the original.
Do you get mainstream scientists at all calling you, Lloyd, saying, hey, can we look at this thing?
No.
Amazing.
No, never had a one do
disappointing,
that.
Disappointing, isn't it?
I practically have to hit them upside the head to get them even to listen to me.
Even if it was, even if it was a deformity from 900 years ago, you'd think they'd still be interested in it.
You'd think they would, because if it is indeed, it is. It's the weirdest one. It's weirder than the Elephant Man for sure. The Elephant Man is understood. I mean, he's weird looking, but he's well understood.
Even made a movie about him.
Right. There is nothing like this, and they don't understand it. And one of the reasons they don't want to deal with it, frankly, is because they don't understand it. If they understood it and could put it in some kind of a pigeonhole, well, they'd be all over it. It would be a fun thing to deal with. But George, you know, when you have a job and you're considered an expert and somebody brings you something that you can't begin to deal with, that doesn't make you happy, does it?
No. Well, I tell you, in my case, I say, I just don't know, you know,
well,
but I don't shut it down.
They're not real good at that. That's not what people pay them to do. That's not what people put PhD after their name for. It's not to say, I don't know. It's to say, okay, here's what this is. Don't worry about it. Everything's under control. We're the experts. We know. And you can sleep soundly tonight. I think that's the big concern with everybody, really.
When do you expect to publish the information in the book on the Star Trek?
Probably not. I won't have the manuscript done probably till toward the end of the year. What I'm going to do is get the people who have been involved in it intimately along the way with me to write brief essays, maybe 2,000 words or so. And I'm going to get those people I'm going to insert what they have to say about it. So it won't just be me talking about, you know, me and all I did. I want to get as many viewpoints as I can from people along the way. And I think that'll make it a much more interesting and a much more real. And that includes people who have negative things to say about it as well. If I can get them to contribute.
We'll get your take on hybridization when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Lloyd Pye.